Mr. Powers, welcome again. You have 15 minutes. You want to reserve any rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor.
Sorry?
3 minutes, if I may.
3 minutes, you may.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm McMillan Powers, and I do represent Rajai Riddick. Once again, this is a case that was tried on a two-count indictment of child neglect under 371.1 A and B. A was null prost at the beginning of the trial, and B went to trial without a jury in front of Judge Morrison. Motion to strike was denied, and defense put on some evidence. Another motion to strike was also denied, and my client was found guilty of child neglect under the statute. Client was sentenced to 2 years. All the time was suspended, conditioned on successful completion of 2 years of probation. The issue really here is whether or not the acts or the omissions or the neglect or the delay in time, whatever, however that time period wants to be categorized between 10:50 a.m. and 12:05, which the record shows is when the child reached the Maryview Hospital, that's 70 minutes. Whatever that action on the part of my client, whether or not that rises to the level under 371B, which would be to have a reckless disregard for the life of this child, for human life. I will agree, and Mr. Riddick agrees, that what he did was stupid. It was thoughtless. He wasn't really thinking right. A lot of things were going on, maybe.
He acknowledged with his first call to the mother, he acknowledged that the baby needed help and had to go to the hospital. So he understood that the injury was such that the child had to go to the hospital. You agree with that?
I agree. We agree that he understood there was an injury, and I think later on he says, you know, I put some stuff on it or there's something on it, it's not really so bad. He kind of waffles a little bit about that later, but it's clear he understood there was some injury and there was some problem. The child, of course, with Ms. Riddick, his mother, and his the mother of the child, and he are not married, but his mother has the child, and it's kind of one of those confused relationships on who actually is custodial, but it doesn't really matter at this point. She was taking care of the child, and she notifies her son, and then he calls the mother of the child, and then we have, and I'm sure you've read the appendix and read that transcript, a very confused chronology as to when things happened, how many phone calls were made, were there two phone calls, three phone calls, did he call her, did she, you know, all of that, where everybody was at the time, all that is irrelevant. The question is, does that act or do those acts show a reckless disregard for human life, for the safety of the child, maybe for the welfare of the child, for the treatment of the child, a lot of other things, but well, is that a disregard for the life?
Aren't we concerned about the health of the child as we are the life of the child?
Charge a different statute. That's the point. Charge a different statute. Under B, and it's set out in our brief at page 7, which the court's very familiar with, the conduct has to be so gross, wanton, and culpable as to show a reckless disregard for human life. Well, does that act, do these acts in toto show that, a reckless disregard for human life? It shows stupidity, perhaps. It shows neglect. It shows inattention. It shows a lot of other issues going on. Maybe I don't want mama to be implicated because she had the child. Maybe I've got some issues with the mother of the child and she's got issues with me. There's a lot of undercurrent of stuff, none of which really relates to what the charge is. The charge is you have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that Mr. Riddick had a reckless disregard for the life of the child. But now, there's Duncan, no issue as to whether or not the life of the child was ever in danger. That's not.
In Duncan, the Virginia Supreme Court said that such reckless disregard can be shown by conduct that subjects a child to a substantial risk of serious injury as well as to a risk of death, because exposure to either type of risk can endanger the child's life. So it can be a risk of injury.
It can be, but the point is this conduct, you still have to look at once again, at the conduct, is the conduct so wanton and so culpable? Is it so gross? Now, you can have conduct that does endanger, and you can fall under the Duncan standard, and that's not the point here. The point here is, do these facts in this case, and our submission is very simply that on these facts, the delay, and you've got all the explanation for the delay. I was calling my girlfriend because I don't have a car. The mother of the child knows I don't have a car. I can't drive, and I'm still going to drive because it's an emergency, and as soon as I can get a car, and all of that. 911 never comes into anybody's brain. I can't explain that. I don't know why that happens, but given all of that, this is the only issue. Does this act, do these acts in toto show that gross and wanton culpability, that total disregard?
What is the difference with Flowers, where the defendant delayed seeking medical attention for two kids over to sleep over who had ingested some drugs?
Well, a couple of distinctions perhaps with Flowers. One is they're clearly, I don't know that they're is a heightened responsibility when they're not your children and you're the custodian of other children, but that's certainly a factor, that you have other children. You have the ingestion of some unknown substance, so you've got some internal stuff. You'd have no idea what's going on internally. That should trigger some other alarms. And then there is a longer period of wait. You've got, I think in Flowers, three, maybe a little bit longer in hours. There's a longer period of time before anything happens, and there is no contact with the mother of the child or children. Those factors are not here in this case. There is an immediate contact with the mother. There's not this extended long wait, and there's nothing hidden in a sense of an internal ingestion of some sort of substance that should trigger, well, you know, I can't see what's going on. I can see the foot. It's burned. Okay, I know that. We've got some stuff on it. I don't think it's going to be so bad. Maybe it's going to be bad. And I waffle on my opinion on that. But in Flowers, you've got something. I don't know what's inside. I have no idea what's going on. And I immediately need to take charge of this situation. I think it's different. I understand that where Flowers can be used, but I just think it's a different situation and is not applicable to these facts. This is a very fact-specific type of situation. And when you look at the statute being charged under A, and then that being null prost, and then being charged under B, and that going to trial, and then, of course, you've got 371, which is the misdemeanor offense. And this probably falls under that as a misdemeanor.
But in this case, doesn't the defendant, Riddick, concede that he knew the child should go to the hospital?
Absolutely knows he needs to go to the hospital.
Is that a recognition that medical attention is necessary?
That's not, Your Honor, that's not the issue. He recognized that, calls the mother, and says, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get the child to the hospital. And she says, no, don't do that. Bring the child to me. And then we have this convoluted conversation back and forth between the parties of bring the child to me, but don't pick me up and take me to the hospital because I've got other kids. That makes no sense to me whatsoever when the mother is saying, but don't take me with you when you know, just give me the child and somehow I'll take her to the hospital. And there's a lot of stuff going on here that with this relationship between all of these parties that's not optimal. And probably not optimal for this child, but that's the record that you're left with.
The trial court noted that appellant asked mother what she was going to tell social services when she went to the hospital when they tried to take the child away from her. Is that what the trial court
said that?
Said that?
Yeah. I don't know that has anything to do with this issue of his actions being so gross, wanton, and culpable as to show a disregard for the life of the child. It does show a lot of stuff about their relationship. I concede that this is a bad relationship. It's rocky. He's thinking maybe she's going to get in trouble with the social services, and maybe I can use that as a tool. somehow, and then she's going to use that as a tool against me so that I won't be able to see the child. I don't know what's going on, but he recognizes that is a potential problem, and also that that may implicate his mother, Ms. Riddick, who had the child when the burn injury occurs. So he has a lot of different concerns there.
Is it a reasonable inference? That's why he took his time to get the child to the mother's, because he didn't want to take the child to the hospital because CPS would start asking too many questions.
I don't think that's a reasonable inference, and the reason for that is ultimately the child is going to get medical help. Therefore, Child Protective Services is ultimately going to be involved, or some agency. You're not going to bring a child in with any kind of an injury, a bruise, anything. There's going to be an inquiry. That's just the reporting mandate. So that's going to happen. For him to believe that delay helps that situation is not a reasonable inference. He may have had delay for other reasons. The most reasonable inference for the delay is simply his explanation. I don't have transportation. She gives me confusing directions. Bring me the child. Don't take the child here. Don't take it to the hospital. Bring it to me, but don't take me. Don't pick me up.
So your bottom line is that while there was a 70-minute delay, that he offered a reasonable explanation for the reason for the delay.
He offers a reasonable explanation, and in addition, when you look at the timeline, there are a couple of timelines here, and I don't know they're consistent, but there's a timeline where he gets a call from his mother, or gets notified by his mother. He calls the girlfriend, the mother of the child, and then there's a 20-minute delay, and she calls back, and then she says that eventually it takes an hour and 10 minutes. That's the bottom line on that one. Ms. Riddick's timeline is that at 10:15, she calls her son, the defendant, and 10 minutes later, he arrives, and then within minutes after that, his girlfriend, Ms. Anderson, who ultimately takes him and the child Ms. Stokely, she arrives minutes after that, and then within 2 or 3 minutes, they leave that house with the child. So we've got a compressed time frame there of maybe 30, tops 40 minutes. So at that, everything's moving quickly, and there is no real delay, if you believe Ms. Riddick's. Well, it doesn't say which the court believed. It just believed that there was some delay, and it didn't really say. So if you've got 40 minutes or if you've got 70 minutes, there's still reasonable activity occurring. I'm walking down the street, and Ms. Stokely is walking down the street. They pass each other. Somehow they see each other in the car. Very confused scenario on facts as to exactly how they're going to transfer this child. And folks, call 911. Take the child to the hospital. That's the easy solution. Nobody thinks to do that.
He said Neosporin on the...
Something. I don't know if it was Neosporin. Yes, he put some sort of...
They put a footie on it.
And then some kind of Band-Aid or bandage.
And when the child was taken to the hospital, that's what the hospital did. They put ointment on it and bandaged it.
They did that. Now, I don't know if he did that or if his mother did that.
I think that the hospital did exactly the same thing.
They did exactly the same thing. So the first aid treatment that he gave was what the hospital was going to give and what any reasonable person would do with a burn. Unless you're an absolute burn technician at one of the major burn units, you don't really know what you've got when you look at a burn. It's whether you've got first, second, third degree. That takes a little bit more training than most of us have. We're familiar with sunburn and little bubbles and stuff like that, and we'll put some aloe or some cream on it and put cold water on it, and that's the best we do, and we hope that nothing bad happens. But I'm going to want to reserve the rest of my time, if I might, unless there's other questions.
We have a minute and 30 seconds.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Martin.
May it please the court, Kathleen Martin for the Commonwealth. The evidence here was sufficient to prove that the defendant was criminally negligent in getting his daughter to the hospital for treatment. When he first called the child's mother, he said that the child had burned her foot and that she needed to go to the hospital. And the mother said, well, you know, bring her to me and I'll take her to the hospital. and then 20 minutes goes by, and she calls the defendant again and says, well, where are you? Where's the child? And that's when he starts to talk about, well, why do you want to go to the hospital, and what are you going to do when CPS gets involved, and that kind of thing. And he said he'd put some ointment on the foot, and it's not that bad, and so forth.
Was there any medical testimony introduced that this child was ever in any danger?
No, there was no medical testimony. There were pictures that were taken at the hospital or right around the time.
What was the testimony about this being a second-degree burn, basically hearsay testimony from the mother?
I'm not sure exactly where that came from, Your Honor. If you look at the record, the judge at sentencing, I believe, talks about how, because there was the motion to set aside was also heard at sentencing, and the judge talks about how this was a second-degree burn. But if you go back and look at the actual testimony, you know, I didn't find where anybody ever testified to that, but the judge picked up that information from somewhere.
And we've got a picture of the burn.
And there are pictures in the record, and it is a very serious burn.
If my daughter suffers a second-degree burn and I, as a parent, make a determination that this is not serious enough to take to the hospital, that I can treat it by putting some antibiotic on it and bandaging it, am I guilty of criminal felony child abuse, child neglect?
That's a very difficult question, Your Honor.
The question in the case, isn't it?
It is the question in the case.
I mean, we as parents make decisions all the time about whether a child needs medical treatment or not. And I wonder how in the world this opinion could be written to recognize good judgment by parents in treating kids at home.
Well, I think in this case, Your Honor, it's not just that the defendant saw that the child's foot was burned and he put some ointment and a bandage on it and then it turned out to be more serious, but that he recognized to begin with that the child had seriously hurt herself.
But it really didn't turn out to be more serious because the hospital, the emergency room, did exactly what he did in terms of treatment.
Well, perhaps. I mean, if we just look at, he put ointment on.
The record reflects that that's what they
but,
did.
But one of the things that I would clarify on that point is that the defendant's mother said that she's the one that mentioned the Neosporin, that she put Neosporin on it, and that the child was wearing these footy things, and when she pulled off the footy, that's when some of the skin came off and some of the skin tore at that point.
You would think that if this child was injured to the extent that his life or health was seriously endangered, that there'd be some testimony in the record to support that conclusion.
Well, I think in Duncan, though, it says that the injury doesn't have to be life-threatening. It has to be, you know, a serious injury, and certainly the pictures, the testimony demonstrated that it was a serious injury. What the trial judge found here to be sort of dispositive, I think, if you look at what he said in the whole record, is that he felt like the defendant intentionally delayed because he did not want to get involved with social services and child protective services, and that was really what was kind of behind the judge's decision in terms of finding that the defendant was guilty of this offense.
That can't elevate the misdemeanor to the felony, the fact that he wants to conceal it because of CPS.
Well, I think that it played into the judge's decision in terms of, you know, is this gross, wanton, and culpable conduct? That this was not a situation where the child is injured, and I think if the defendant had just said, certainly, well, you know, I can't get there because I'm waiting on a ride, or my car broke down, or something, you know, that might put it in a little different context.
What is the cause of the delay?
Well, I think the cause of the delay, it's a number of factors, Your Honor. First of all, you know, we do have the fact that the defendant didn't have a driver's license, and he apparently had to wait for his girlfriend.
What went on for an hour and 10 minutes that caused him not to get there? I mean, it's one thing if you've got the kid laying in the middle of the street, run over, and you go to the neighborhood bar and brace up with a couple beers. But what happened during that time? I know difficulties he might be,
we don't really know
what happened, do we?
We don't really know exactly what happened. I mean, all we can go on is this testimony that came out via the phone calls, and apparently he was waiting for his girlfriend or someone to come and give him a ride, but yet initially, when he called the child's mother and said, the child needs to go to the hospital, I'll come pick you up, there was no question there about how he was going to get there. And he didn't live that far away. He could have walked, for that matter. And he didn't live that far away from the hospital. But the fact was that there was this delay. The child's mother called him a couple times. The hospital, as I recall, was about 15 minutes away from where the defendant's mother lived, and that was about 10 minutes away from where the child's mother lived.
But don't we have to have, in a case like this, either something that is so obvious that, as the court has said, the trial court can use its common sense in determining this really did pose a threat to the health and well-being of the child, or we have to have some medical testimony that says this injury was so severe that had the child not received prompt medical attention, he or she would have died or been seriously injured.
Well, I think that certainly would be helpful to have that.
Not just helpful, but
I think
necessary.
I think that the trial court here could look at the pictures of the injury and determine that this was a serious injury, that it did not have to be, as I said, life-threatening, and the common sense is that if you have a burn that looks this bad, according to the pictures, that, and it's a 2-year-old child, that you need to take this child to get medical treatment. And the defendant intentionally delayed, which is shown out by the fact that he tried to talk the child's mother out of taking the child, about because they made these comments about social services. And there was different testimony about the timelines that all this happened, but the trial court pretty much did not believe the defendant's witnesses.
The concern about child protective services or how the child was injured, that might go to establishing that his actions were wanton and culpable.
Right.
And clearly, if he had delayed because of those same concerns and the child had suffered a very serious injury, we wouldn't
right.
be here.
Right.
But even if you prove his actions were wanton and culpable, you've got to get to that next step. And I'm just having a hard time, without some help from a doctor here, assessing, just looking at a picture and saying, well, that's obviously...
Well, it's so apparent
that the trial court was correct in its determination.
And that's the crux of this case, Your Honor. But, you know, the record is what it is. And, you know, all I can just continue to say is that this is what the trial court believed. This is what he found. And it's not totally an unreasonable decision based upon the evidence that is in the record. You know, this is not like the Shanklin case where the child's burns were duct taped and no one could see them. That, you know, this is more like the Flowers case where the defendant knew that these children in her care had ingested some sort of drug. She didn't know what. She waited several hours. Then she called a parent of one of the children who didn't even live nearby, when the parent who did live nearby, she did not call. And so it's kind of that same sort of thing where the defendant's actions were such that there was a delay in getting the appropriate treatment, and it was not really something that you can contribute to sort of a good reason, like there would be some sort of, you know, the defendant just couldn't help himself in doing this. And so...
The mother, he suggested that they take the baby right to the hospital.
Right.
She said, no, bring him to my house.
Right.
And she said something that there were other children.
Right. She said that she had other children with her and there wouldn't be room in the car. And I agree with defense counsel. I don't understand that statement.
She ultimately took the child to the
hospital. And ultimately she did take the child to the hospital. And the only actual time frame that we have that's sort of concrete is that the child got to the hospital at 12:05 p.m. And so, you know, there are a lot of things here that were not really explored perhaps as well as they could have been, that would have made this case a lot easier. But, I mean, what it comes down to is that the trial court had a reasonable basis for his decision, and we'd ask that you affirm the conviction for those grounds.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Martin. Mr. Powers? We have a minute and a half.
Very briefly, let me just make two or three comments. Counsel has said here that the acts of the defendant show that he was criminally negligent. That's not the standard that we're looking at. You can be criminally negligent and be guilty of child neglect under 371 as a class one misdemeanor. That's still criminally negligent. So that's not the standard. And I think that that's the problem that we have here is, what is the standard? The standard is set forth in the statute. It's been repeatedly stated. It's got to be gross, wanton, culpable act that has a disregard for the life. Now, that's what we're looking at here, and I don't believe that that has occurred. I will just address one other issue and I say this with some tenderness. On page 10 of the brief by the Commonwealth, at the very top, it says, considered in the totality, Riddick's actions, these are the actions of the defendant during this 30 to 70 minute period, whatever it is, all of these actions taken together show willful conduct that evidence reckless disregard for his daughter's well-being. And I think that's where the problem lies. The standard is not stated properly here. The standard is not a disregard for well-being. That's 371. That is misdemeanor class one child neglect. That's not what this case is about. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll greet counsel and take up the last case.